Welcome back. This is episode 10 of Brogan, the Suspicious Death of Aladar and the End of Horse Racing's Golden Age, the podcast. I am your host, Denise Cueto.
And I'm Fred Cray, the author, and I bet you didn't think we were going to go over episode 10, but we are.
So last time we were talking about you're getting ready to go to CrimeCon. Since then, you attended. What was it like?
It was massive. It was massive. We set up. We had a great booth that was right near where all the presentations were happening. Mm-hmm. There were over 5,000 people there. We sold out all of our paperback books.
That's great.
So we had to resort to selling the hardbacks for the paperback price. We got rid of almost all our merchandise, the hats and the shirts. Yesterday, CrimeCon sent out a recap, you know. Mm-hmm. And our booth was one of the six chosen to be in the picture of that recap. So I thought it was great. I mean, I almost lost my voice the second day.
From talking
too much, yeah. You know, I met investigators. I met, podcast guys. And two of them have, you know, asked me to be on their show. So I think it was a great networking opportunity. But it was also a great to meet all these people that didn't know anything about it. Mm-hmm. You know, people would come up and say, equine, true crime, what is that? And, you know, a lot of people were interested in animal law. They didn't know what it was. And, you know, they'd say, well, what is animal law?
Right.
And so, you know, I would give them some examples of it. You know, like, hey, you're living with your boyfriend or significant other and you break up, who gets the dog? That's animal law. You know, your dog bites somebody and they want to put it to sleep and you want to defend your dog. That's animal law. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody steals your dog and you want to get him back. That's animal law. Somebody says your pit bull's a pit bull by just looking at it and wants your pit bull to be banished from the city. That's animal law. So people are like, wow, I didn't even know any of that stuff existed.
Yeah.
So I had a great time. It was very tiring.
I can imagine. And 2 days.
3 days.
3 days.
And so it was...
So what else happened at the event?
Well, I think that's about it. We did have a life-size Aladar cutout, mm-hmm. and there were many a selfie taken with that cutout, and it was pretty cool to watch people. They were so thrilled to be able to see the actual horse, right. You know, and take their picture next to him. So, and our booth was the only booth that had that. The other news this week is that I commissioned a painting of Aladar from Jessica Leonard, who is an equine artist. And on my Twitter account, we're starting to show the process that she's going through. So sure, first she draws a pencil drawing, and then she started with the ears, and the last post was of his eye, you know, starting with his eye. And it's incredible to watch that process of a painter painting a picture. You know, I've never seen it. And it's beautiful. I mean, you look at it and you go, wow, Aladar this painting is going to be a real tribute to a horse that really deserved it.
Yeah, you can see it on social media as well. You can see pictures of it and follow along.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to seeing it finished. And, of course, I'll post the finished picture. But I've always wanted to do that for Aladar, and I think it was really definitely the right thing for the book. Mm-hmm. A lot of people said, I can't read this book because I care more when an animal dies than when people die. And I get that. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised at that.
So it's been quite the journey. And it's been really interesting going from having read, you know, the rough draft to the final copy. And I agree with you. There is something very special and different about talking about it, conversing, seeing pictures, listening to interviews. And now there's even the audiobook, which I think is another great way for listeners to experience the book.
Yeah, and the audiobook is, you know, I like the narrator. It's mm-hmm. a very polished, interesting way to his interpretation of the voices and everything.
And at the beginning, we talked about how your goal with the book, with the podcast, was getting Aladar's story out there, bringing him the respect he deserved and didn't quite get in death. And just bringing his story to a wider audience, which you've done.
I've had many people write me and say, you know, Aldar will always be remembered. At the last sentence in the book, I say, I was at peace, and they said, you should be at peace. Mm. So there's been a lot of what I would say is validation, a lot of pride that I was able to, as an author that never wrote a book before, write a book, have all of the critical reviews, and many fans write me and tell me, that they loved Aldar, even though they never knew of him before because of the book. And it's just been a fairy tale ride to me.
Yeah. Well, it's been a very good time. I've enjoyed myself, and we hope that the listeners have as well.
I've also been asked to talk at the Keeneland Library for their library series, which had been a question mark. The Kentucky Book Fair rejected my book for signing. And in February, when we get close to that date, I'll post something on my social media about it. But it'll be good.
Awesome. So I was rereading the book, and it kind of hit me when you were first writing it and when I first got the copy, your original copy, that was at about 600 pages.
It was.
Your final product is not 600 pages.
A lot was edited out. What I learned was from the publishers that, any book over 375 pages is an automatic no.
Really?
So, when I started out writing this book, I just said, okay, I'm going to write everything I can find and know. And that was 600 pages. Well, I was constantly worried about it because there's a lot of, you could say there's a lot of repetition of what happened, but every story is different. It was so interesting to get the title.
Yeah.
Which the title is just so great, Broken. It signifies so many things that are broken in the book. So his leg is broken. That's the most obvious thing you think of. And then after that, you're thinking horse racing is broken. Managing the horses at Calumet is broken. The farm is broken. It's a great title. And the way we brainstormed it into existence was just an example of creation in process.
Yeah, it was a really great process. And as you mentioned, there are so many layers to this book. And right from the front cover, it captures it. Broken, the suspicious death of Aldar, and the end of horse racing's golden age.
And the picture itself, we searched a long time to get this picture, and the way they have colored it in a sort of pale white makes it look very eerie.
Yeah.
And then the typeface, the sort of old-fashioned typewriter font with the red in it. I love it. I love everything about it. The only question that I have about the entire Aldar thing is who actually did it and how they did it and who else was involved. And I think there are three people who probably know the answers to those questions, and that's J.T. Lundy, Susan McGee, and Janice Hines, and they have never talked about it. I actually tried to talk to Janice Hines a month ago, and I got her on the phone, and she said, "Don't you dare call me. How dare you call me? How did you get this number?" Hmm. And then she said, "Why would I want to talk about a horse that died 30 years ago?" And I thought, well, because
right,
but I always thought that those three people must have told somebody something. Mm-hmm. But I never found it in researching them. I even talked to Alton Stone's brother, I talked to JT Lundy's sister, so I still think there's somebody out there that knows the answer to these questions. Well, when J.T. Lundy took over the farm, it was in the black. 10 years later, they owed $160 million. They rented private jets. They bought jets. They, you know, resurfaced the racetrack three times. They completely redid all the grounds. They bought two horses for $50 million. They traveled all over the world. They went to France. They went to Australia. They took a whole bunch of people with them. It was J.T. Lundy's way of saying, I'm a redneck farmer, son of a tenant farmer, and I'm going to show you that I can do whatever I want whenever I want to.
So arguably, the insurance payout then came in quite handy.
Yes. But it didn't come in handy enough to save them. And what people don't realize is that the money that did get paid, not much of it went to Calumet anyway. So that's where, you know, you have to think about following the money. But there's no way in my mind that you can take all of these events together and say, oh, it was an accident. Because, you know, even looking at the medical aspect of it, Dr. Bramlage's job wasn't to go and put together a case. His idea was, what was the way I can find this is an accident? You know, how could that have happened? He didn't go out to the stall and say, well, I don't see any evidence of that. That's not his job. And Tom Dixon just said, well, if Bramlage thinks it's an accident, that's good enough for me. Bramlage is going off what he considered the most likely accidental scenario he could think of. And that was that there had to be a twisting motion in order for the cannon bone to be broken. I sent the x-rays, and, you know, based on the x-rays, they felt that this was a twisting motion. So I sent the x-rays to Dr. Susan Stover, who is a person who has been investigating the deaths at Santa Anita track. Why are horses breaking their legs at Santa? And so she knows a lot about trauma and, you know, how horses break their legs and the mechanisms. And she's looked at thousands of x-rays. And what she told me was, look at this x-ray. You can't rule out that this injury came from a crowbar or a baseball bat. So, you know, and she's not related to the horse racing industry. She is a person who's in the Groves of Academy. She's at UC Davis, I think. And she's a person who is as qualified, if not more qualified than Dr. Bramlage, to look at an x-ray and see what happened.
So nothing really ruled out foul play.
Later, that evidence came forward in terms of paperwork from the farm and the bankruptcy, that it was found that Aladar was not making that money.
Why do people think that somebody purposefully, intentionally broke Aladar's leg?
Because the farm was in such dire financial straits that it could barely make payroll. And that a week before, the night watchman was told to take the following Tuesday off, which just happened to be the day that Aladar was injured. That 2 weeks before that, before Aladar died, one of the insurance companies told the management at Calumet that they were going to cancel their insurance policy. So if you're going to cancel your insurance policy by the end of December, if you want to get the full value of what Aladar's insured for, you've got to do it before it lapses. And then there was the issue of Calumet owing First City National Bank of Houston, you know, about $50 million. And if they didn't pay an interest payment on that money before January, then First City National could foreclose on the farm. And having no other assets, the only asset they had was the insurance money.
Tommy Burns is a hitman. How did you come to find out about him? How did you learn about him?
Well, I learned about him early in the case because he's in the Sports Illustrated article where Aladar's death, questions about Aladar was written.
Right.
It's his story. He was also mentioned by Terry McVeigh, who was a insurance adjuster for Golden Eagle and investigated Aladar's case. You know, he mentioned this Tommy Burns and the equestrian killings is what I call them. What brought it out was he's now on Netflix in an episode of Bad Sports called The Horse Hitman. And as I was writing the book, this was on. And again, my wife said, you know, you should interview that guy. And so I thought, that's right, I should interview that guy because he is like an expert in killing horses. Mm-hmm. And that's something that nobody ever had in these cases. Mm-hmm. In every lawsuit, you have the witnesses and then you have an expert, mm-hmm. you know, who says, look, I'm an expert in this and this is what I think. And the jury listens to that. And Tommy Burns would have been an expert in Aladar's case if he had been called because he knows more about killing horses and has had experience with killing horses more than anyone that I know of. So then I had to start to search for Tommy Burns. And I found him, I drove out to his house. And it was the same scenario as when I went out to interview the on-site veterinarian Rhodes. You know, you get stuck in front of this horse gate, and there's the keypad entry, and you're sitting there, and you're, you know, I'm trying out 1-1-1-1, 1-2-3-4. You know, nothing's happening. I'm not getting in. And somebody pulls up behind me in an old pickup truck. And, you know, they say to me, just like Rhodes Stewart, who are you and what are you doing in my driveway? Mm-hmm. You know? So I explained to her, listen, I'm doing this book and, you know, Tommy is Burns is involved in it. She said, well, I'm his wife and I'm sure he'd like to help you. Give me your number and he'll call you. And I thought, yeah, he'll call me. And he called me the next day. And so we made an appointment and I went down there. And it was the most conflicted interview that I had because here's a guy who killed 15 to 20 horses for the insurance money. And I love animals. And I'm thinking, I don't know if I can stand to talk to this guy. Mm-hmm. But I have to talk to him because it's part of writing this book. And so I'm thinking, you know, how is this going to go? I don't want to be mean to the guy. I want to have an open and neutral mindset. So I took all the evidence down with me, the pictures that Tom Dixon had, the x-rays, you know, so he could look at it. So I go out there and this guy is an amazing guy. He is penitent. He is remorseful, and he is a pathway into criminality that I would never have otherwise. He's talking about arson. He's talking about beating people up. He's talking about killing horses for the insurance money, and he's saying it in a way that is true, and he's saying in a way in his voice that he's sorry. And he's a smart guy, and I've said this before. If he had had a different life, it would have turned out maybe he was a professional of some kind. But at age 15, he leaves home. He gets into alcohol and drugs, and he teams up with – he unfortunately gets to be – his father figure turns out to be Barney Ward, who's an equestrian. He's involved in equestrian sports. And it's Barney Ward that gives him the names of people – that want their horses killed for the insurance money. And Tommy does it many different ways. And part of his penance was having to go through with the prosecutions of all the people that paid him to kill horses for the insurance money. It's known in the horse industry that, you know, if you break a horse's cannon bone, they're not going to make it. Tommy Burns was arrested by, I think, the FBI, when he and a partner broke a horse's leg, his cannon bone, as he was going up a ramp into a trailer, and they were going to say, well, the horse broke his leg when he fell off the ramp. But everyone in the horse business knows you break the horse's leg like that. It's a major weight-bearing bone that if the horse isn't worth $1 million, you're going to put the horse to sleep. And so it's a way of killing a horse quickly.
Testing. All right, this is Fred Gray and Tommy Burns on, what's today's date?
2nd, November 2nd, 2021. I did lots of crap, anything you can imagine, but I was good at it because I've had a plan. My point is, somebody like me that was professional, before I did anything, I planned it out.
Right. What's your thought on it? You think that somebody went in there?
Absolutely. Yeah. Somebody did. I think somebody broke the horse's leg. There's no doubt about it. But that, I think, my opinion is that somebody made this look like a scene of the crime.
Yep.
With the latch and the roller and
you
everything.
If somebody who's in this would be bright enough to think about that. And, you know, how would you?
Well, I would.
Know. Well, you wouldn't know it was.
You got to be
way.
A criminal sometimes to think like, you know what I mean?
What I'm saying is,
you're asking the right guy.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. Yeah.
So,
I mean,
you go
time.
In there and you say, and you don't know that it's corroded when you go in there.
That's probably the farthest thing.
And then you go in there and find it. Just
you probably did that before you did the horse. You know what I mean? So you could get the hell out of there. That's what I would do. I'd go in there. I'd make the crime scene, then do the horse, and get out as fast as you can.
And that's something you'd look at.
Oh,
the bracket.
I would look at the whole situation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Either I would have, which is virtually impossible, to get a horse's leg and put him in the bar and make it look like that. Okay.
Right.
Or I mean, you just look at the whole picture. But if I was looking at the picture, it's like us. We had when we broke the horse's leg in Newbury, Harlow and I, it was the same thing. What's the right amount? Oh, we were loading at night on a horse trailer, and it slipped, and it was wet, and it was late. I mean, same thing. You had the whole...
You had to create.
And we had another guy looking. I mean, it's the same thing what I'm telling you. We had to create the story so when they get there. And that's what I'm saying. To me, it's just a staged crime. There's nothing there that, you know, they find some weak thing like that and wiggle it loose and whatever. I just don't. I don't buy that for 1 minute. I had never done nothing like this. I have friends who
are talking about streetwise.
Streetwise. And I called up somebody in Chicago and said, what happened? They're the ones who told me to cover his eyes. And
so you had somebody you called and told you how to do it?
Yeah, I'd never done that. They burned barns, suffocated horses with fucking garbage bags.
Balls.
Yeah. The only way people like breaking the legs because it's automatic payout, you know, and there's not. I know one deal where it collect and they sent it somewhere else. Took 2 years for somebody to get paid. Something like that is kind of cut and dry,
right?
You know what I mean? It's kind of like doing an arson. It's right. Okay, the house is burned, end of story.
Yeah.
But what was the cause? What was the and then they start looking at people's finances. So if you were to ask me, I would have put them in the stall, broke them with a crowbar, and made it look like that was it.
You would have put the blanket on in the stall.
Yeah, just covered his head where he can't see it coming.
Okay.
It's an awful fucking thing to even think about.
Right.
Done. Because if you put a blanket over his head, okay, or something over his head, okay, if you've tried putting blinders or something, he's not going to stand still for that long unless somebody's holding him.
Yeah. Well, I
not long enough, and they got to be holding still. That's what I mean. Like you said, somebody's going to be sitting there with a heaping the horse quiet, petting it or something like that, and put some over his head, and then the other guy whacked.
But
that's a staged
crime
scene right there. That's what that is. That's,
there'd have to be other evidence. To
the common sense rule, there's no way he could have done that.
And I think there's also the idea that, you know, the simple explanation is the right explanation.
Well, it's like this, too. So they can show the insurance adjuster, this is what happened.
That's what they did.
Okay. Now, if that wasn't there, how did the insurance company, how did it happen? Broke his leg and stall. Virtually impossible.
Yeah.
Okay? So, you don't, there's no payoff.
Yeah.
For, till you take him to court, 5 years later, you might get paid. Right. You might not. Had, obviously, they had to make it scene of the crime. You know what I mean? To justify how he broke his leg. Because a horse isn't going to just break his leg in a fucking stall.
Yeah.
No, I'm just thinking that somebody...
I
personally would think that somebody would break the horse leg in the stall. A, to take the chance, you wouldn't want anybody to to see you, you know what I mean, in an aisle by any chance, and B, the horse don't get away. I mean, look at that one at Harlebrook. And they did this just to make it show away how it did. It's hard to explain how a horse would just be in the stall and have a broken leg. You know what I mean? There's, you're not, you know what I mean?
You think that someone would be smart enough to do that? To keep that stall bracket out?
Sure.
And leave it there to
make it look like a point. Yeah. I mean, you know, they always, you got to show a motive in a way and stuff. Yeah. I mean, I was a professional criminal and wasn't even killing horses. I burned a house down for somebody one time, and I threw stuff out in the driveway purposely to make it look like, even though I didn't rob it, we made it look like the house was robbed and burned, and it worked. The cops did the same thing. How somebody robbed it. You would have to find a reason. You know what I mean? Yeah. It'd be the same way if you were gonna, you know, pull insurance for rob your house. You want to make it look like, you know, you want to break the glass going in, not out. Just, as a ex-professional criminal, that's what somebody I did. If I wanted, I would know, being in the horse business, in this, that a horse is just not going to break its leg in the stall.
Right.
There's no way. You can't get a speed. You can't. There's just not enough. There's no way. In that case, if that horse would have broke his leg when he got hard on the bars, you know, that would have made, okay, here's the cause. This is how he broke his leg, even though he didn't. And this, they almost got to show, this is almost like, that's why I think it's more of a crime when I see something like this. Do I think that's the way that horse died? No. And I also think they might have found, they like you said, the paint chipped all over the wall. They'd make a fucking mess. If he got his leg caught up in that leg, in that door, there would have been a big mess. There'd be not only blood, all that paint would have been chipped away and everything else. It wouldn't have been clean at all. Being around horses my whole life, I know a horse can't just break its leg in a stall. It just doesn't happen.
Right.
Okay, well, how would you, the first thing, how are we going to make it look he broke his leg? He got it caught in the door.
Right.
He didn't, no doubt about it. And like I said, it's a two-man job. My opinion, absolutely.
So one person would hold it and the other one would...
And make sure the horse is blind and doesn't come up, because...
And then you get out of the stall as fast as possible.
Get out of there.
Yeah. How would you have done this?
I would have gone in with the stall, thrown a blanket over his head, to had somebody with me.
So you're saying that you would go in the stall with two guys.
Well, one other guy. Yeah, the less people involved,
right. The more secret it is.
It is. So you want to look out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
You want to look out, but you might not have a lookout. You might have that one guy you can trust.
Right.
You know what I mean?
All right. So you're in the stall. You've got a crowbar on you. You've got a guy who's got the horse head. Now, the stall is long. In other words, it's longer than it is
wide. These are 12 by 12s,
So how do you, exactly what would you do?
You got to give it a big blow, I mean, for that to do. Again, that's like breaking a 2 by 4 to break it. First of all, you know what, you just, again, you don't want anybody to see you. Second of all, you got to take the chance of the horse getting loose. That's exactly what I would have done.
So you would have broken that off to leave it as evidence?
Made it look like that was
the cause.
That was the cause. He got his foot stuck in there. But I would... First, the horse doesn't get away. Now, it's going to look pretty bad.
Well, that was a pretty interesting interview. I would have imagined, before having heard it, before you talking about your experience, I was pretty judgmental. And I would have been, as I'm sure you were, worried about the interview and what would come of it. But it did give me a very different perspective, which I wasn't expecting.
Yeah. That's one of the contradictions of Tommy Burns. But I think one of the things this case has always lacked is someone who knows how to do this, giving an opinion about how it could be done and the way it would be done and why it would be done that way. And I think his opinion is pretty logical.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on things that he's done and knows about. And his discussion about leaving evidence so that there can be a reason attributed to how the accident happened for people to find is important. I think that he's very persuasive. And I think of all the people that that have discussed this, obviously he has the most experience.
Absolutely.
And in a bad way.
Right. So I'm glad that you were able to speak with him.
And, in the end, I liked the guy.
Mm-hmm.
There was something about him that was honest and remorseful and in another life, he would have turned out different.
Right.
After the interview was over, he took me over to we went out for lunch.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not the only one who feels that way. The FBI agent who was the agent in charge of these equestrian killings picked him up from jail. And they're friends. And this is shown in Bad Sports, the Horse Hitman, where, they get together after he gets out of jail. They talk. He is a man who you feel like has done his time and deserves a second chance.
Mm-hmm.
And he loves horses. He has a barn full of horses. And I said, why do you have these? He said, well, none of them make me any money, so I guess it's my penance.
Mm.
And what was really wild was we were sitting there talking and we heard a horse kick the stall door. And he interrupted the interview and said, that's what it sounds like. Now, we're sitting far away from the barn. And, it's interesting because, whenever you have a case, you should go to the scene and you should hear the horse kick. Because if you're anywhere near that barn, if Alton Stone was within 100 yards of that barn at that night when there was complete silence, he would have heard that. And you would have heard that. And a horse kicking the stall door does not sound like a horse breaking his leg or getting entangled. And so that sound adds another piece of evidence to me to mm-hmm. this case. I showed him the Aldar stall, the interior of Aldar stall door, the shot that Dixon took. He said, yeah, you want to come look at my stall doors, they'll all look the same way. Horses kick with their front feet. No horse turns around and takes his full weight and kicks the rear right-hand leg into the stall door.
Right.
He's never heard of it, never seen it. And the most emotional part of his interview, which was not recorded, actually, was when we were talking after the interview, and I said to him, Barney, you went to the FBI and you turned in all the guys that pay you money to kill their horses for the insurance money, but you didn't turn in Barney Ward. He said, no, I felt like he was my father. I owed him allegiance.
Hmm.
I said, well, what happened? And he said, well, the FBI came to me one day and said, look, we know you're protecting Barney Ward. Let us play you this recording. And on the recording is Barney Ward saying, he's never going to see the courtroom. We're going to take him out. Something Ooh. To that effect. Or we're going to get to him or whatever it was that he mm-hmm. said. And Tommy Burns burst into tears 30 some years later, listening to that, telling that story to me.
Yeah.
And it was like a deep, uncontrolled sobbing. I'm thinking this is so deep that just talking to me about it, however many years later, he still feels this. And this is when after it was over. And so I came away with it feeling like Tommy Burns had deserved a second chance, and he's doing the best he can with that second chance.
And to be clear, Tommy Burns had nothing to do with Aladar's case, with the incident. He was just someone who you wanted his perspective
Correct.
On.
And the FBI asked him that because, it was around this time. It was after Aldar's death, I think, that all this equestrian stuff came out. And when they arrested him, the first thing they asked him was, did you have anything to do with Aldar?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no. And so I think, but people thought he's a guy. And I asked him, I think during the actual interview, if you didn't do it, well, who would have done it? Who were other names? And he said, listen, there's always somebody.
Mm-hmm.
There's always that guy. And Calumet or the bank would have known who that guy was if they were in the horse world. Mm.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Broken, the Suspicious Death of Aladar and the End of Horse Racing's Golden Age.
Join us next time for our final episode.
I'm your host, Denise Cueto.
And I'm Fred Cray, the author. And next time, you're going to hear my closing argument and get a code to give your verdict on the internet.
Very exciting. Be sure to tune in. See you then. Our podcast is a production of Hazeltime Studios. This episode was produced and edited by Ashley York and John Fee. We hope to see you next time.